Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, November 22nd. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Survey. Focus is on capital discipline. Analyst. We saw operators live within cash flow and return lots of cash to investors. By Mella McEwen. A survey of leading energy banks has found expectations of higher commodity prices, but not a correlated rise in producers' borrowing bases, the amount of credit lenders will extend to producers. Usually, borrowing base increases correspond with prices, said Kim Mai, a member of Haynes & Boone's Energy Practice Group. The lack of increase in borrowing bases indicates continued increased caution, she said. Everyone is still being conservative, whether they think commodity price increases are temporary or it's the corporate culture moving forward, she told the Reporter Telegram in a telephone interview. Even so, the international corporate law firm saw a record number of banks participate in its fall 2022 Energy Bank Price Deck survey, which Mai said reflects a heightened interest among banks to gather industry-wide details about price decks in light of the continued uncertainty surrounding commodity prices. Responding banks aren't expecting robust borrowing base increases, which have resulted in producers seeking alternative financing, such as asset-backed securities transactions. Price decks for both crude oil and natural gas increased significantly from the spring survey, with the mean gas base case rising to $5.21 per MMBTU from $3.63 in the spring survey. The mean base case for West Texas Intermediate rose from $67.34 in the spring survey to $71.52 in the fall survey. Mai said the price increases are consistent with expectations oil and gas demand will continue to outpace supply. Mai noted that the industry mindset has appeared to change, with investors, particularly private equity, steering clear of the industry until it focused on capital discipline. We saw operators live within cash flow and return lots of cash to investors, she said. That means operators are not under as much pressure to quickly develop their assets, resulting in less demand for capital. It will be interesting to see if the new model continues in this new high-price environment, she said. Even though there's not much demand for capital, Mai said supplies of capital remain tight as banks have consolidated and decreased oil and gas lending. I expect any oil and gas lending will be carbon neutral, she said. The strength of the oil and gas industry amid high commodity prices will be great for those banks still lending, and smaller regional banks will see continued growth, she said. This article is entitled, Oil Industry Has Swagger Back. Companies position themselves for transition, in which fossil fuels play a smaller role in world's energy mix. By Kyra Buckley, Houston Chronicle. Houston. Another quarter of record profits. Another quarter of rising stock prices. Another quarter of happy investors. The oil and gas industry, riding the highest prices in nearly a decade, has its swagger back. Again, the indispensable player in a world desperate for energy. After years on the defensive as a fading industry that could no longer deliver for shareholders, the oil and gas sector is capitalizing on its advantage, showering investors with returns, pressing its policy agenda in Washington, and rebuffing the entreaties of President Joe Biden to significantly increase production to ease high prices. But, analysts say, oil companies should enjoy the moment. As executives bask in the glow of short-term profits, much of them driven by Russia's war against Ukraine, the industry faces the same long-term challenges that have threatened its future in recent years. Despite generating some $1.4 trillion in free cash this year, companies have invested precious little of it to position themselves for the ongoing transition in which fossil fuels play a smaller and smaller role in the world's energy mix. Oil companies may have little choice but to favor the short term as they try to win over and hold skeptical investors with generous payouts. But the strategy has long-term implications for Houston, where the future may well depend on whether the region's critical energy industry can make the transition to a low-carbon environment. Despite eye-popping profits, analysts said, U.S. oil and gas companies have done little to develop or invest in a sustainable, long-term business strategy. They didn't have one before Ukraine, said Tom Sanzillo, director of the Cleveland-based Nonprofit Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis, which advocates for a sustainable energy industry. And unless we expect these kinds of geopolitical manipulations to continue, whether it's a war or something else after it that makes for artificially high prices, I don't know that they have anything but a short-term gain here. Short-term gains indeed. For the third quarter, Houston independent oil company ConocoPhillips reported that profits surged 90% from a year earlier to $4.5 billion. ExxonMobil had its best quarter ever, earning nearly $20 billion in 3 months, and said it distributed $8.2 billion to shareholders while spending $5.7 billion on long-term investments. Bloomberg data shows this year Exxon, Chevron, Shell, and French energy major Total Energies will distribute about $100 billion in profits to shareholders, while only reinvesting $80 billion back into their core businesses. But as companies race to pay shareholders, analysts said, the firms are left with little flexibility to steer investments elsewhere. They have committed to this new financial model, said Bill Gilmer, director of the Institute for Regional Forecasting at the University of Houston. And this new financial model says, we companies are going to have to maintain pristine balance sheets, and we're going to have to, from this point forward, reward investors by diverting 30 to 40% of all of our free cash flows to dividends. Past and future. It wasn't always this way, Gilmer said. In the past, investors were attracted to oil companies because of the prospect of long-term growth. While oil companies provided shareholder returns, they were expected to reinvest profits to grow the business. The shale boom changed that model. As investors pumped billions into new drilling projects requiring more technology and equipment, companies focused on growth and quickly ramping up production. But the bonanza investors and companies expected didn't materialize. The high costs of shale drilling, producers need oil at $65 a barrel to break even, according to Gilmer, limited profits. And when a global oil glut sent prices crashing from more than $100 a barrel in 2014 to less than $30 in early 2016, losses mounted. From 2015 through 2021, more than 600 energy companies carrying more than $320 billion in debt filed for bankruptcy, according to the Dallas-based law firm Haynes and Boone. Growth lost its luster. As prices stayed low through the rest of the decade, fewer investors were willing to send money to the oil patch. In 2014, the energy sector was valued at just over 10% of the S&P 500. By 2020, when the pandemic drove the second major oil bust in 5 years, energy accounted for less than 3% of the S&P's value. This recent history has all but forced oil companies to focus on short-term profits and deliver them to shareholders as crude prices this year reached their highest levels in more than a decade. The strategy, however, is shaped by the future as well as the past. Climate change and policies to address it have created uncertainty about the industry's future and more hurdles for investors, with some projections estimating that oil demand could peak as soon as the end of the decade. Investors have grown skeptical of the prospects for fossil fuels. Even with the recent surge in profits and stock values, energy still accounts for only 4.5% of the value of the S&P 500. Less than half of the industry's share in 2014, and a far cry from the 28% in the 1980s. That leaves oil companies with little choice but to keep investors happy in the short term. What this focus on short-term profits means for Houston is less growth, said Gilmer. Despite high oil prices, local employment in the upstream oil and gas industry has fallen by more than one-third since 2014 to 157,000 from 240,000. The jobs aren't returning because high oil prices no longer mean the industry drills more oil, Gilmer said. It's not financing, environmental activists, or government regulations stopping oil companies. It's investor pressure. Investors would rather companies stick to production schedules and rake in the cash instead of increasing output, which could lower consumer costs and add jobs, but eats into investor payouts. Drag on economy. As the industry follows this path, said Gilmer, it will become a drag on the local economy, which normally grows around 2% a year. Over the next few years, Gilmer expects growth to slow to about 1.6% due to changes in the energy sector. At the same time, fossil fuel alternatives are becoming more affordable and attractive to investors, and the transition to cleaner energy may come faster than previously expected. In 2021, global investment in low-carbon technologies reached $755 billion. A nearly 27% increase from $595 billion in 2020, and nearly triple the $264 billion spent in 2011, according to Bloomberg data. The International Energy Agency, an intergovernmental energy research organization, estimates that 13% of all new cars sold this year will be electric, up from 9% in 2021. The IEA reports the share of renewables in global electricity generation reached 28.7% in 2021, up from 19.8% in 2010. Government policies, such as the recently passed Inflation Reduction Act, which includes billions in incentives for clean energy, are helping speed the transition. Todd Staples, president of the industry group Texas Oil and Gas Association, rejected analyst claims that the industry is focused on short-term gains at the expense of a sustainable long-term strategy. He called such assessments misguided and blamed political rhetoric about climate change and phasing out fossil fuels as hurtful to investment and growth in the industry. Most publicly traded oil and gas companies have committed to lowering emissions and developing technology to aid the energy transition. Nearly every company, however, expects to increase oil and gas production in coming years. Last year, the industry invested around $10 billion in clean energy, according to the IEA, representing less than 4% of capital investments. IEA expects it to grow to 5% this year. Hugh Daigle, associate professor in the Petroleum and Geosystems Engineering Department at the University of Texas at Austin, said some oil companies will try to branch into new forms of energy, and some will go all in on producing the oil and gas the world is expected to use, even as economies shift to clean energy. For example, European companies like BP are moving into renewable technologies. U.S. public companies mostly prefer sticking with fossil fuels while investing in technologies such as carbon capture, which removes carbon dioxide from industrial emissions or the atmosphere. Private companies mostly remain focused on oil and gas production. It's not a zero-sum game. I don't think one path is going to win out over the other, Daigle said. The industry is at an interesting point where there's multiple paths forward, and the reason for that is because of the energy transition and the diversification of energy sources. Sign of decline? Sanzillo is not as sanguine. He said the industry's focus on short-term profits to the neglect of long-term investment reflects a sector that recognizes its prospects are declining. Russia and the other countries and the oil companies know their days are numbered, he said. And the way you get money now is to squeeze every last nickel you can get out of the barrel of oil. That's what's going on here. This article is entitled, Second President Built Teams to Work for Common Good. The first 50 years of Midland College. President Jess Parrish, 1981 to 1991. By Rebecca Bell. When Jess Parrish joined Midland College in 1981, the college was well on its way to becoming an outstanding institution. Parrish, a native West Texan from Ballinger, served as the founding president of Shelby State College in Memphis, Tennessee, before joining Midland College. This is my kind of education, Parrish said in an interview for Midland College, the first 25 years. I have been blessed with the opportunity to know and understand and have feelings for community colleges. I haven't changed my opinion from the day I went into them. Parrish was instrumental in leading several accomplishments at Midland College, which include the following. Creating a health sciences division that established many of the college's health sciences programs, including the Registered Nurse Associate Degree of Nursing program, and constructing the 22,000-square-foot Davidson Family Health Sciences Building, doubling the size of what would become known as the Scarborough Student Center, initiating the college's successful Kids College Summer Enrichment Program, reorganizing and expanding the Adult Continuing Education and Adult Basic Education programs, coordinating with the Abel Hanger Foundation to offer tuition-free scholarships to graduates of Midland County High Schools, acquiring acreage on the north part of the campus that became known as the North 40. Jess had an informal style, Deanna Savage, special advisor to the president, said. He was supportive of individual differences, diversity, and innovation. He would openly say, people take jobs and create and turn them into whatever they choose with their own strengths. He let people shape the college, and much of those efforts still stand today. In addition to his responsibilities on the home front, Parrish was also an active community college supporter and lobbyist at both the state and national levels. As a result of his efforts, he won the Marie Martin Outstanding Junior College Administrator Award in 1986, presented by the Association of Community College Trustees. His informal approach and leadership capabilities led to his being named one of the top 50 community college presidents in the country in a study conducted by John Rutsch and George Baker of the University of Texas. When Parrish retired from Midland College in August 1991, he said he couldn't think of a better way to spend the last 10 years of his professional career than to spend them at Midland College. The roots and foundations were here, Parrish said in a 1996 interview. I inherited an excellent community college, and I quit while I was having fun. I remember Dr. Parrish as a community builder. Retired Associate Vice President of Instruction Stan Jacobs recalled. I believe his greatest accomplishments had to do with building teams within the different areas of the college and encouraging them to work together for the common good. He understood the importance of the different constituencies and appreciated their differences. Parrish enjoyed life in Midland for more than 20 years after his retirement. He passed away in February 2015. Rebecca Bell is the Executive Director of Institutional Advancement at Midland College. This article is entitled, School Location Delays Texas Lodge's Alcohol Permit, by Mella McEwen. Questions around the presence of a bar and grill near a school prompted a delay in considering a request for a specific use designation with term for the sale of all alcoholic beverages for on-premises consumption at a restaurant. Planning and Zoning Commissioners Monday were considering a request by Alyssa Carzo for the specific use designation at Texas Lodge Bar and Grill at 503 East Interstate 20, Suite 130. But the presence of Richard Milburn Academy, 250 feet to the west, and the approval of such a designation to Garrilee's Mexican Restaurant, 75 feet east of the school last December, gave commissioners pause. Ultimately, commissioners voted to defer a decision until a certified letter asking the academy if they objected to the designation could be sent, though the school sent a letter stating it didn't object to the designation. Garrilee's received its designation because it was mistakenly believed, city staff told commissioners, the academy was a private school. But the academy has since clarified it is a public school for grades 9 through 12, and commissioners wanted to ensure fairness to the academy. Texas Lodge is currently in operation without a designation and operates from 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. daily. If it receives its designation, it proposes alcohol service during those same hours. Commissioners approve request for veterinary clinic. Commissioners unanimously approved a request by Midland DCI, LLC, for a specific use designation without term to establish a veterinary clinic at 3722 West Loop 250 North at the intersection of Fielder Street and the Loop. An existing 3,435 square foot building already on the property will be used for the clinic. No animals will stay overnight. Midland DCI representatives said animals needing overnight stays would be transferred to sister clinics. Hours will be 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. In other action, commissioners approved, with staff recommendations, a proposed preliminary plat of Lindsay Acres at Marlin Avenue and Morin Street to divide a tract into five residential lots. Commissioners approved a final plat of Ashland Place at Western Drive and West Golf Course Drive to divide a tract into two lots for future development. This article is entitled City. Texas Rangers Investigate MPD Officer-Involved Shooting, by the Midland Reporter-Telegram. The Texas Rangers are investigating a Midland Police Department officer-involved shooting that occurred around 12:45 a.m. Sunday, according to the City of Midland. The city reports that officers with the Midland Police Department responded to a disturbance at the Why Not Midland location at 4416 Briarwood Avenue. During the incident, an officer's weapon was fired, striking Christopher Hernandez, 23 years old, of Midland. Hernandez was subsequently arrested for evading arrest in a motor vehicle. The officer whose weapon was discharged is on administrative leave pending an internal investigation and the investigation by the Texas Rangers, according to the city. As per Midland Police Department protocols, the Texas Rangers are called as the lead investigative agency for incidents involving shots fired by a Midland Police Department officer. This column is called In Brief. DPS, intoxicated driver causes four-vehicle collision on I-20. A McAllen man was arrested for two counts of intoxication manslaughter after driving the wrong way on Interstate 20 in Reeves County and causing a four-vehicle collision that killed two people, according to the Texas Department of Public Safety. DPS reported that Juan Orta Gonzalez, 30, was driving a 2020 Toyota Tacoma eastbound in the westbound lanes of Interstate 20 near mile marker 19, when his vehicle struck a 2015 Toyota Corolla with a driver and two passengers from Denton. As a result of the collision, the Corolla was left disabled in the center of the westbound lanes, according to DPS, and a 2023 Volvo 760 with trailer struck the Corolla, which was then struck by a 2023 Peterbilt 579 with trailer. Both passengers in the Corolla, Stephanie Ferrer, 44, of Denton, and Leilani Ann Orr, 18, of Denton, were pronounced deceased on the scene, according to DPS. DPS reported that the accident took place around 3:29 a.m. and that the roads were wet. They also noted all occupants of the vehicles were wearing seatbelts. DPS, Denver City woman dies in crash in Gaines County. A 32-year-old Denver City woman died after a Friday evening accident in Gaines County, according to the Department of Public Safety. DPS reported that Lorena Paz Alvarez was traveling southbound in her 2014 Nissan Versa on Farm to Market 2055 when she failed to negotiate a curve and veered into the East Barrow Ditch, where it rolled over, according to DPS. The driver was ejected from the vehicle, DPS reported. The driver was transported to the Yoakum County Hospital in Denver City, where she succumbed to her injuries. DPS reported that Paz Alvarez was not wearing a seatbelt. DPS, Palm Springs, California man dies in I-20 accident. A 65-year-old man from Palm Springs, California, died Saturday after a collision in Reeves County, according to the Department of Public Safety. DPS reported that Johnny Lee Allen Triplett was driving a 2016 Kenworth 680 with trailer westbound on Interstate 20 around 19 miles southwest of Toya when he failed to control his speed and struck a 2019 Freightliner Columbia with trailer from the rear. The Freightliner was stopped in the right lane due to backed up traffic on the roadway, according to DPS. Triplett was wearing a seatbelt. The accident took place around 4:01 p.m. DPS also reported that the road conditions were wet. This column was compiled by the Midland Reporter-Telegram. This article is entitled, MISD Elementary Teacher Needs Help Gifting Books, by Ben Schaffer. Last week, the Midland Chamber of Commerce held its State of Education. The topic was literacy rates in the Permian Basin. This week, another area teacher is asking for reading materials for her students. Ms. Miller, a pre-K to second grade teacher at Pease Communication and Technology Academy, is seeking funding for each of her 23 students to be gifted their own book. The project expires March 13th, and there is $139 still needed to fully fund it. This could be the book that helps them decide what they want to be when they grow up. Or maybe it is just a fun read, Miller posted. She added that providing books students enjoy reading is a great strategy for teaching them reading skills. Donate online at donorschoose.org/my-fairy-own-book/700-3169. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled Oil Bounces in Volatile Session. OPEC Headlines Cause Turmoil by Julia Fanzarez, Bloomberg News. Oil paired losses and climbed from January lows after Saudi Arabia denied a report that it is discussing oil production increases. Brent futures traded near $86 after falling below $83 a barrel on Monday. Saudi Arabia denied reports that OPEC Plus is considering an output increase of 500,000 barrels ahead of the EU's embargo of Russian oil. The earlier report sent markets spiraling and pushed Brent's prompt spread briefly into contango, an industry term for when current oil prices are cheaper than contracts for delivery further out. Prices were still trading lower, pressured by a dimming outlook over Chinese demand. China saw its first COVID-related deaths in almost 6 months over the weekend, just as a city of 11 million near the capital asked residents to stay home amid an outbreak, sparking fears of a further wave of restrictions in the world's biggest oil importer. Crude has erased the gains made at the start of the quarter when the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and Allies, including Russia, agreed to reduce production by 2 million barrels a day. A looming European Union ban on Russian seaborne flows and Group of Seven price cap plan are crowding the outlook, with officials possibly set to announce the cap's level on Wednesday as they step up their response to Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Goldman Sachs Group, Inc. lowered its fourth quarter forecast for Brent crude by $10 to $100 a barrel, according to a note, with the reduction driven in part by the possibility of further antivirus measures in China as cases climb. This article is entitled Saudis Deny Report of Talks on OPEC Plus Increase by Salma El-Wardani, Bloomberg. Saudi Arabia denied a report that it is discussing an oil production increase for the OPEC Plus meeting next month, and said it stands ready to make further cuts if needed. Crude futures paired earlier losses, trading 1.8% lower at $86.04 a barrel as of 5:18 p.m. in London. The current cut of 2 million barrels per day by OPEC Plus continues until the end of 2023, Saudi Energy Minister Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman said in a statement via the Saudi press agency. If there is a need to take further measures by reducing production to balance supply and demand, we always remain ready to intervene. Oil futures earlier dropped as much as 6.1%, dipping below $85 a barrel for the first time since September, after the Wall Street Journal reported that the kingdom and other members of the group were considering raising output by as much as 500,000 barrels a day. That would have been a major reversal after the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies decided in October to cut production by 2 million barrels a day. President Joe Biden has slammed the move, saying it endangers the global economy, and aids fellow OPEC Plus member Russia in its war in Ukraine. After an initial rally following the cuts agreement, crude prices have declined as the economic outlook deteriorates and China continues to grapple with COVID-19 outbreaks. OPEC twice reduced its forecast for global oil demand, and Prince Abdulaziz has said the group will remain cautious due to uncertainties about the health of the global economy. Saudi Arabia has already cut oil exports sharply this month to deliver on the OPEC Plus agreement, according to data from energy analytics firm Kepler Limited. The cartel's next meeting is scheduled for December 4th. This is the obituary column, Tuesday, November 22nd. Jana Iverson. Jana Sue Iverson, 81, a very wonderful, giving, and loving wife, mother, and grandmother of Midland, passed away at home peacefully on Sunday, November 20th, surrounded by family. She joyfully joins her husband of 44 years, Wendell Welch Iverson Sr., who preceded her in death in 2006. Jana was born May 3, 1941, in Fort Worth. Jana is preceded in death by her husband, Wendell W. Iverson Sr., and beloved sister, Joe Ray Davis. She is survived by her two sons, Wendell W. Iverson Jr. and his wife, Susan, and Andy S. Iverson and his wife, Tanya, as well as five grandchildren, her sister, Jerry Ann Inman, and many nieces and nephews. The family asks that in lieu of flowers, donations be made in Jana's honor to Hospice of Midland. Visitation will be Wednesday, November 23rd from 5 to 7 p.m. at Willowbrook Funeral Home. Jana will be buried privately with her husband on the family ranch at Devil's River. Robert Thomas, Tom Sherman. Robert Thomas Tom Sherman, 84, of Midland, passed away on November 10th. The family received visitors Tuesday, November 15th, from 1 to 3 p.m. at their family home. Tom was born on January 10, 1938, in Sentinel, Oklahoma, to Orville and Gladys Sherman. Tom is survived by his loving wife of 62 years, Billy Whitehead Sherman, his brother Ron Sherman of Grand Junction, Colorado, his two adoring daughters, Leslie Ann Ware of Midland and Laura Sherman Mellencamp of Grapevine, his son Robert T. Sherman Jr. of Houston, as well as seven grandchildren and four great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his mother, father, and sister. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to the New Mexico Christian Children's Home. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home, and online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Troy McCall. Troy McCall, 65, of Midland, passed away on November 17th. Troy was born in Albuquerque, New Mexico, to Christopher and Janie McCall on August 17, 1957. Troy is survived by his wife, Terry McCall, Billy Joe Mills, Chris McCall, and Larry Don Burton. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, November 22nd at Willowbrook Funeral Home, with Reverend Dr. Jimmy Braswell officiating. Interment will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are entrusted to Willowbrook Funeral Home, and to place online condolences, visit www.willowbrk.com. Death Notices. Roman Baker. Roman Baker, 40, of Midland, passed away November 18th. Services are pending with Willowbrook Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Midland.
Good morning, this is Kim, and I'm reading the Odessa American. Today's date is Tuesday, November 22nd. Odessa couple accused of 8-year-old's death. a West Odessa couple have been arrested on suspicion of capital murder in the death of an 8-year-old boy, who authorities say was strangled to death. According to an Ector County Sheriff's Office report, dispatchers received a call on November 5th about an unresponsive child from the 2000 block of North Huntington Avenue, and when deputies arrived, they found firefighters performing life-saving measures on Arturo Francisco Coca. Arturo was taken to Medical Center Hospital, but life-saving measures performed there were unsuccessful. Investigators and hospital staff noticed Arturo appeared malnourished and small for his age, according to the report. They also saw he had lacerations on his head, legs, and back. The boy's mother, Megan Lang, 29, told her Arturo had woken up after defecating and urinating on himself, so she carried him to the bathroom, bathed him, and took him into the living room, the report stated. She called 911, she said, because she was talking to him when his head fell back and she realized he wasn't breathing. Investigators learned through 6 other children in the home that Arturo's stepfather, Rodolfo Reyes, 33, was also home when the boy died, the report stated. Reyes acknowledged he was home that day Arturo died, but denied hurting him, the report stated. He later requested legal counsel and didn't provide any other information. Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths said Lang and Reyes attributed the boy's death to diabetes, but a forensic pathologist ruled the cause of Arturo's death was asphyxiation by manual strangulation with underlying causes of neglect. He found the boy to be malnourished and he saw hemorrhaging in his neck. Warrants were issued for Lang and Reyes Thursday. They were arrested Monday on suspicion of capital murder of a child under the age of 10 and injury to a child. No bail has yet been set. According to his obituary, Arturo was a third grader at Burnett Elementary. He loved playing football with his brothers, iPad games, and Call of Duty and Fortnite. His funeral was November 15th. Students offer views on support they need. Students in Ector County's ISD's AVID program spoke about what they need from the community, the need for better mentoring and financial support, especially when it comes to dual credit, at a recent youth symposium. Presented by the Permian Basin Teen Pregnancy Prevention Coalition, it was held at the Woodson Boys and Girls Club. Some of the seniors participating were Natalia Aguilera, 17, from Odessa Collegiate Academy, Jamarian Lane, 17, Braden Pry, 18, and 17-year-old Brooke Wooldridge. Aguilera plans to attend Texas Tech University to likely study biology. Pry, Angelo State University to study sports management or kinesiology. Wooldridge wants to become an ultrasound tech but is undecided on where to go to college. And Lane wants to become an artist but also is undecided on college. The original prompt was to basically read a speech about what you need your community to do to better help you as an individual and all the other students. So what can the community do to help us become more successful, Lane said. Wooldridge said she felt what they needed from the community was better mentors, people who would be there to guide them to a better future. I also felt like we needed more financial help with school, especially when it comes to dual credit classes, with bettering our future. It's hard to finance it, and I feel like if we had a better financial chance, then more kids could better their future. Price said he thought they needed more opportunity because there had been multiple cases where people haven't been able to get what they want or they've had to do certain things to be able to get to the places that they need to be without any help. Lane agreed, saying he believes they need more chances and better opportunities. We need to focus on those students as individuals instead of just a whole group. So more emphasis, mental health, tutoring, and even possibly getting up a system to where we can have a grace period in between our regular, rigorous work schedule and stuff like that, Lane said. He added that it was the first time he had done public speaking. Lane said it was kind of nerve-wracking, and he was relieved that he got through it. Wooldridge said she had done things like public speaking before, but I'm also a very social person. It doesn't really bother me. I was anxious, but I felt like it was needed. It was important, she said. It also just betters our chances of getting into colleges and building a career, Wooldridge said. Lane said the program has kept him organized in his academic life. Without that, I wouldn't be nearly as organized or nearly as hardworking as I am, Lane said. Fry said Avid has helped him with organization and just knowing how to be better in school, but also out of school, Fry said. Before I was an Avid, I had no idea where to even start on how to get into college. That's all I knew is I wanted to go to college, but didn't know where to start. And so coming into Avid, it helped me set up a plan to be able to start somewhere. It helped me to know what I want to be when I grew up and overall what to do and what to know, Pry said. Wooldridge said no one in her family could answer her questions about college, so to have Avid and to have someone who has been experienced and can help us is a great thing to have, she added. They all have a sense of community and family from Avid. It is a very supportive and safe place to be most of the time, Lane said. When one of us succeeds, it feels like we all succeed. It's just really good at bringing everyone together to unify on one common goal, and that is to succeed in whatever we want to do. And I feel like Avid does a really good job bringing that sense of camaraderie to each other. Aguilera at Odessa Collegiate Academy said her Avid teacher recommended her to speak at the symposium. She had previously spoken at Odessa College Student Government Association panel. She picked me because I was already comfortable with speaking to an audience, and she felt that I'd be really good at that, Aguilera said. She said the speeches each student gave were varied. For me personally, I'm under McKinney Vento here at school, so I'm an unaccompanied youth. I don't have my parents here with me, and for me, what I need, not having that support from home, I need it from school, Aguilera said. Her family is scattered all over the place. Originally, she is from here and wound up back in Odessa. She lives with her aunts. When it comes to making decisions about college, she said, she truly needs the support from Avid teachers and the community. I don't think that I would have gotten the opportunity before. I don't think I would have offered myself to do this speech. I don't think I would have had the same motivation or encouragement in any other environment. So I think having that in my Avid teachers is really great, Aguilera said. She agrees with the Permian students that Avid is like a family. It's especially true in a smaller environment like Odessa Collegiate Academy. Since she was a little girl, she's had her heart set on going to Texas Tech University for college. Aguilera expects to earn an associate degree in general studies before she graduates high school and go on to Tech in fall 2023. She's planning to go the biology route right now. Education Foundation gets $175,000 grant to support fine arts. The Education Foundation of Odessa announced Monday that they are the recipients of a $175,000 grant from the FMH Foundation that will help support the growth of the fifth grade strings program in ECISD and assist in the Permian High School auditorium revamp that is currently underway. The Permian Basin has a rich history of excellent fine arts programs, and EZISD continually seeks to invest in projects that enrich the lives of the students in the Permian Basin and foster creativity and self-expression. These funds will support the new 5th grade strings program in ECISD, providing new instruments to the program that will allow the district to increase the number of students participating. The grant will also assist with the continued renovations to the Permian High School auditorium, specifically with the sound and light booth that supports students from multiple campuses across ECISD and hosts several events for the UIL Music Region 6. The FMH generously funded a new sound system in the auditorium through a previous grant to the Education Foundation, and this new handicap accessible booth will ensure that equipment stays protected for years to come. The EZISD Fine Arts Department is incredibly grateful to the FMH Foundation and the Education Foundation for their continued generosity to both our EZISD students and the Permian Basin community. This grant will allow students across the district to access the new 5th grade strings program and will greatly improve the production capacity at the Permian High School Auditorium, said Erin Hawley, Director of Fine Arts, ECISD. Abortion ban back on city agenda Tuesday. 3 new city council members will be sworn in at City Hall Tuesday night, and one of the first things they'll be asked to do is declare abortions illegal in the city of Odessa. It's not the first time the idea of a sanctuary city for the unborn has been broached. During Mayor Javier Hovind's first meeting in January 2021, he asked the council to pass a sanctuary city ordinance, but council members Steve Thompson, Tom Sprawls, Deetra White, and Mary Willis shot it down. "This is not a city issue. We have other priorities," Willis said at the time. Then, in August 2021, Hovind tried unsuccessfully to get council members to approve a special citywide election on the matter. However, Sprawls, White, and Willis didn't run for re-election, and they are now being replaced by Chris Haney, Greg Connell, and Gilbert Vasquez, all of whom ran unopposed. When running, Haney said his top priority would be making Odessa a sanctuary city. On Monday, Connell said he'll also be voting in favor of the ordinance. "I think God will be pleased," Connell said. "I think it will bless the city." While some women believe it's their body, their choice, Connell said unborn children are a completely separate entity comprised of genes from both parents. Vasquez did not return a phone call seeking comment. Thompson said his views on the matter haven't changed. "The state of Texas has taken care of the situation, as has the federal government," Thompson said. "I think I have also said that I'm not going to push my religious beliefs back on the public. This is a religious choice, not a political choice. Let's move on and take care of the city's business." The proposed ordinance for a sanctuary city for the unborn does not consider it an abortion if the doctor is removing a dead, unborn child whose death was caused by accidental miscarriage, is removing an ectopic pregnancy, or if they are trying to save the life or preserve the health of an unborn child, which is defined as a natural person from the moment of conception. Jonathan Mitchell, an Austin attorney, submitted a letter to Mayor Javier Hovind stating he'd represent the city at no cost in any litigation that results from a decision to enact this ordinance. According to the proposed ordinance, because the U.S. Supreme Court struck Roe v. Wade down, states now have the right to ban abortion, and the state of Texas never repealed its pre-Roe v. Wade statutes. that outlaw and criminalize abortion unless the mother's life is in danger. However, despite the Supreme Court's decision, the proposed ordinance states state officials may have limited abilities when it comes to imposing penalties on those who violate the state's abortion statutes. As a result, the proposed ordinance states the City Council of Odessa finds it necessary to supplement these existing state law prohibitions on abortion murder with its own prohibitions on abortion, and to empower city officials and private citizens to enforce these prohibitions to the maximum extent permitted by state law and the Constitution. It goes on to read, to protect the health and welfare of all residents within the city of Odessa, including the unborn, the City Council finds it necessary to outlaw abortion under city law and to establish penalties and remedies as provided in this ordinance. According to Texas Local Government Code 54001B1, a fine or penalty for the violation of a rule, ordinance, or police regulation may not exceed $500, except that 1. A fine or penalty for the violation of a rule, ordinance, or police regulation that governs fire safety, zoning, or public health and sanitation, other than the dumping of refuge, may not exceed $2,000. The proposed ordinance would also make it illegal for anyone to aid or abet a woman in obtaining an abortion by driving them to an abortion provider, giving instructions on how to self-administer an abortion, giving them money to pay for the procedure, or coercing them into getting an abortion. If the council moves forward with the ordinance, it would go into effect December 13th, following its second reading. Quick hits: free blood pressure and glucose screenings. The Medical Center Hospital Family Health Clinic West University, 6030 West University Boulevard, has scheduled a free blood pressure and glucose screenings from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. each Tuesday through December 27th. Visit tinyurl.com/2YVKB55C. Trev the Road Poet. The Ector County Library, 321 West 5th Street, welcomes poet Trev the Road Poet Wainwright from Castleford, West Yorkshire, England, at 5:30 p.m. today on the first floor. William Christopher Brown of Midland College will MC. The event is free and open to the public. For more information, visit tinyurl.com/23 2ND2MM. Percussion Ensemble Concert. The West Texas A&M University Percussion Ensemble has scheduled a concert at 7:30 p.m. today at the Mary Moody Northern Recital Hall on the Canyon Campus. Admission is free. Volunteers needed. Downtown Odessa Incorporated is looking for individuals, groups, and organizations that would like to volunteer during the Parade of Lights, Market, and Letters to Santa event Saturday. Visit downtownodessatexas.com or sign up at bit.ly/parade of lights volunteer. For questions or to sign up as a group organization, call 432-335-4682. Keep Odessa Beautiful is seeking 20 adults ages 18 and older to volunteer for the HEB Feast of Sharing event December 9th at the Ector County Coliseum, Barn E. There are two shifts to choose from, or do both from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. and from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Volunteers for each shift will be required to work the various recycling stations located throughout the event. To register, visit tinyurl.com/BDZR73CS. Medical Center Hospital is in need of volunteers for its volunteer services. Applications may be found online. To apply or for more information, call 432 640 2249. Email jjones1@echd.org or visit tinyurl.com/YFJJMYHC. Odessa Regional Medical Center is in need of auxiliary volunteers. The auxiliary is open to men and women of all ages. For online registration form, visit odessaregionalmedicalcenter.org/volunteer. For more information, call 432-582-8399 or email caitlin.folan@stewart.org.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.